All right, all you movie junkies, it is time for the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim.
And welcome one and all to episode 32 of the SLS Cast. Yes, 32! Two things about 32, the year 32 was a leap year, and Christ was said to have been crucified then.
They also say that 32 is the new 23.
Yes, 32 is also not envious of 33, because it is surrounded by mystery on the back of a Rolling Rock beer bottle.
And 32 is the number of piano sonatas by Beethoven completed and numbered.
And the Route 32 bus in Philadelphia will take you from Roxborough to Center City.
And 32 is the atomic number of the chemical element geranium, which is to say 32 is the number of protons found in the nucleus of its atom.
Really? Because in the 32-bar form, each chorus is made up of four 8-bar sections.
Oh, come now, good sir. I say that the Route 32 bus in Philadelphia will take you from Roxborough to Center City.
That's good. Except I said that like four of them ago.
Oh, you did?
Yes, I did. So I win because apparently we found the same thing. Stop copying my shtick, motherfucker.
Well, I think I just found out that Matt just goes onto Google and types in fun facts about the number 32.
You damn straight. So, all jokes and fun about 32 aside, I am Matt.
And I am Tim.
And how are you doing, good sir?
I am doing well. I grew a little mustache this past weekend for a little 1950s party I went to. And I gotta say, it's not working as well as I hoped it would.
Okay. I've got to say, I'm not sure that's a good move for you.
Well, the stash hair is blonde, and it's not filled in as much. I mean, it basically looks like a mustache full of peach fuzz. For this party, I had to go through and get my girlfriend's eyeliner and kind of dab some eyeliner on my upper lip. It either came off as a slick and sly mustache, or I just licked a dirty butthole. I don't know.
I really hope that that did not go with the latter of the two of those choices.
No, not at all. Maybe a little bit, but
no. Oh, terrible, terrible.
So how are you doing?
I'm doing all right, doing all right. Went to a, kind of on a whim, went on to a little singing competition at a local bar, and I won. So that was kind of cool.
Cool. Did you win some cashola, or do you just kind of go on to the next?
I plunked down a whole $5 and won a whole $75.
Cool.
And I get to go back on the 27th and go shoot for $500.
Cool. What song did you sing?
They had us sing two songs, and so I did The Change by Garth Brooks and I'm Yours by Jason Mraz.
Aw. Did you serenade them both to your wife?
She wasn't there. Just kind of said, hey, I'm going to go do this. And she's like, okay, have fun.
Did you serenade both of them to Rob?
Nobody was there. It was just me. I was by myself.
So that is why you won? Because you were the only one there?
Yes. Yes. Me and 12 other people. I was the only person of my own social circle who was there. There were other people in the bar.
Oh, gotcha.
However, now that I'm doing the finals thing, now everybody's like, oh, I want to come. Oh, I want... So I'll let you know how many people actually turn up for that.
Don't give into that. They're only wanting to follow you because you're becoming famous. That is the only reason why.
That's okay. Maybe they'll start listening to the show too. And then we'll become more famous. And then more people want to listen. And we can parlay this into some kind of weird, crazy, successful podcast.
Oh, come now.
With some karaoke move thrown in.
Nobody will ever admit to listening to our show.
Hey, all 31 people.
Yeah, all 31 people. They won't even comment.
We know they listen. They just don't comment. And we're in the tens of people who listen to the show every week. Are you kidding me? It's fantastic. We'll have even more. We've had, I don't know, May was kind of a good month, and then it just kind of dropped off after May. But we are, you know, we do literally have hundreds of hits through iTunes. So we know there's people out there listening.
Yeah, yeah. Not bad. It must be because of we're talking a lot about we are talking about a lot of really crappy movies that I think a lot of people enjoy listening to the commentary of.
I think that it's the public service we provide
that too.
By making sure that others do not have to watch these movies.
That too.
All right. Well, I'm glad that you're doing well, butthole mustache aside, and I'm doing well aside from the fact that apparently I have no friends or family who want to support me doing anything.
Oh, we broke
through.
We're
just
you.
A couple of winners, man.
We broke through. Wow.
We're doing great. Well, I guess with all of this uplifting talk, should we just go ahead and jump right into
it? Yes, we will hold our boob sacks high and trot on.
Outstanding. Then let's do it, brother. We got the news. The news. Okay, I guess shall I go first, or do you want to go? I don't care. You want to flip a coin?
Do you have?
I got a coin right here.
What kind of coin?
It has to be. It just fell off the desk. Hang on, let me flip it. Okay, I called it, even though you didn't hear it, and I said tails, and it landed heads. So you get to go first.
That was cheap.
That was quick, wasn't it?
That was weird, and quick, which is I'm kind of used to that. If you. Know what I...
Awesome. Go ahead.
Okay, so Disney, despite the loss that is The Lone Ranger, Disney is still the first studio to make $1 billion this year, which is 2013. And how did they do that? Actually, Deadline broke the news on this matter, which they talk about how The Wizard of Oz, or I'm sorry, Oz the Great and Powerful, the prequel to The Wizard of Oz, received mixed reviews. However, it still pulled in $257 million internationally and $234 million domestically, which makes for a grand total of $491 million globally, and that is only to date. And then their next big movie was Iron Man 3. And this one was embraced by audiences and critics. It broke box office records. And this movie declared the fifth highest grossing movie of all time worldwide. And it pulled in $406 million. And that globally leapt to $1.2 billion. And then the third movie, which just came out this past month in June, Monsters University, made an outstanding $227 million domestically in only 3 weekends. And already its worldwide total has surpassed $411 million. And still, Disney has 6 more movies to release. They have The Planes, which is the spinoff to Cars, which was actually supposed to be a direct-to-DVD movie, and they basically went through and recast all the voice actors, and I believe John Cryer was supposed to be the lead plane, the main character, but then Dane Cook went through and redubbed all the lines. So I guess Disney is now able to make some of these risky moves and put more crap into theaters. As well as Planes, Thor, The Dark World, is going to be released this year. You got Frozen, Saving Mr. Banks, which is the Disney movie about Walt Disney and Mary Poppins, and the making of Mary Poppins. You have The Delivery Man, The Fifth Estate, and then also, in the near future, you have the Star Wars movies. So this will not be the only time that Disney will bank $1 billion before any other studio. I mean, I imagine this will happen more so and in more and also in a greater amount. $1 billion. I think Disney will continue to make really shitty movies every once in a while because they can. Not necessarily, you know, they're not really taking a gamble on making these movies because they can actually...
I don't know. I think it's a matter of maybe they just wanted a tax write-off. They said, "What's quick, we need $150 million tax write-off. Dollar tax write-off. What are we going to do? The Lone Ranger. Yes! Go! By God, Simmons, you're a genius." And then this also goes to show that if you truly own everything, you will eventually make money. Because There's none of them. The only original Disney property that they had, if I'm correct, is the Lone Ranger, and that's the one that's lost money. Everything else has been Marvel, Pixar, all that related, right?
Kinda. I mean, the Oz the Great and Powerful was Disney.
Oh, that's right. Okay,
yes, and that was a huge one. So
yes, okay.
But hey, at least with the Lone Ranger, they got in good with the Comanche Indians. So if anything good came out of it, it was embracing culture. In some weird
there
way.
You go.
In a very that's... expensive, I don't know.
I don't know. Maybe somebody said, how can we say sorry for Peter Pan? Because they're really pissed at us about that one, even today. I know. Let's make the Lone Ranger and lose a crap load of money on it. All right. Sounds good.
Success. And it worked. Now, moving on, cinemablend.com via thefilmstage.com. James Cameron disapproves of the 3D used in Iron Man 3 and Man of Steel. And these are two movies that were that took the post-conversion, post-3D conversion effect that a ton of movies do. I mean, a lot more movies than a year or two ago, or even 3 years ago, are now being actually shot in 3D. But then there are still as many more, if not more, movies that are being post-converted. And a number of them do not look good at all. Because a lot of these movies, the studios that are putting out these movies don't care about what the movie looks like or the effect that the movie will have on the audience's health, because all they want is the extra $5, $6, $7 surcharge that, you know, getting the glasses entails. James Cameron, conversing with a fellow filmmaker, Alfonso Cuarón, who just so happens to have directed Children of Men, which, if anybody knows, is one of my all-time favorite movies. Soon out will be his movie Gravity with George Clooney and Sandra Bullock, which is a movie they're lost in space or on a space station and suddenly something happens and they just kind of start floating into space. That movie was filmed in 3D, and James Cameron had a heavy hand in the 3D process of that movie. So they're having this discussion, and James Cameron goes on to say, in regards to the use of 3D in Iron Man 3 as well as Man of Steel, saying that, quote, I do not think Hollywood is using 3D properly. The reason I say that Hollywood is not doing well is because it is automatic. For example, The Man of Steel, Iron Man, and all those movies should not necessarily be in 3D. If you spend $150 million on visual effects, the film is already going to be spectacular. Perfect. He goes on to say, quote, one thing is shooting in 3D, and another to convert to 3D. After Avatar changed everything, good and bad movies, everything has to be in 3D since Avatar. The problem I see now is that instead of it being a filmmaker issue, is a matter of the studio to make money and are pushing 3D to directors who are not comfortable or do not like 3D. End quote. And he's referring to directors such as Christopher Nolan and happened with Clash of the Titans when Warner Brothers was pushing 3D onto director Louis Leterrier, and he did not want to do it at all. It looked horrible. In fact, that shitty 3D began the big discussion on whether is 3D prevalent in the movie industry now, or is it just a big gimmick? But it wasn't until Avatar and Hugo when beautiful 3D finally came to the movies, and it actually meant a little something to pay the surcharge and actually enjoy the movie. And then with Christopher Nolan, famously rejected the pressures from, again, Warner Brothers to have The Dark Knight Rises being 3D. I mean, kind of like what James Cameron said in the during his quote, that a lot of these movies stand on their own without the 3D. The only thing that the post-converted 3D will add to a number of these movies is just an annoyance. Nothing to the story, just an annoyance. Gimmickry. I don't think James Cameron saying all this stuff really isn't going to matter or do anything, make any dent on the way a number of people view 3D movies, since a number of us still go out and pay the surcharge. I mean, personally, I make it a point not to see 3D movies unless they were shot in 3D, but, you know, I guess we all make mistakes sometime. Now, my last bit of news pertains to the American Drive-In. I know, Matt, where you are at in Texas, not too far away in this little bitty town of... is it Magnolia or...
It's Tomball.
It's in Tomball? Out in Tomball. Mm-hmm. There's the Showboat Drive-In, and I've gone there multiple times. Cool drive-in. You pay your $5 per person. Is it per person or is it per car?
Basically, you take a carpool of people and it only costs you like $20.
Yeah, it's not bad. You get to see two movies. I mean, it's just a great experience. However, it looks like our children and our children's children will have a less likely a chance to experience the wonders of the American drive-in because currently film is going out of distribution. Distributors are not going to be giving out film anymore. Therefore, movie theaters have to upconvert from film projectors to digital projectors. There are currently 360 drive-ins remaining in the United States. Now, distributors, and this is via theall.com, and they say that distributors are about to stop shipping 35mm film and shift entirely to digital distribution. This is little hazard to commercial cinemas, but a clear peril to drive-ins. As of January, the Los Angeles Times estimated that 90% of fewer than 400 remaining drive-ins had not converted to digital. Now, to put all this in perspective, the conversion from analog to a digital converter in our household televisions and whatnot back in, I guess, 2007, 2008, 2009, cost between $40 and $70. A shift from a film projection to a digital projection costs about $70,000 per screen. And that is not just like a one-time fee. Every year, they have costs for year-round temperature control for the projector. And in most drive-ins, it should come as no surprise that bills are going to pile up. You have the lamps, for example, because a lot of these movies are being filmed and shot in 3D. It takes a type of lamp to do 3D movies, to do these crazy high-def movies. Lamps burn out, especially for the projectors for drive-in movies. They have to reach a greater distance. And, you know, just all of these costs amount. And it's ridiculous. So then the All also says that a wide range of fundraising campaigns have been launched to aid these conversion efforts. You couldn't make these efforts sound more affecting, whether they're relying on Kickstarter or simply checks in the mail. So if there is a drive-in near you that is in dire need of a little bit of funding, donate a little money, or make an effort to visit that drive-in once a week, twice a month even, and do them a favor and don't try to hide your kids in the trunk or anything, not just because they might die of asphyxiation or anything, but because you want to do the American thing and pay for them and go and enjoy this piece of American culture that has been around for years, 60, 70 years. I mean, hell, the first drive-in movie theater opened, I believe, in the 30s. When this is gone, a piece of movie history is gone as well. I mean, it kind of blows. It'll be sad for me to see these puppies going away, but
I don't know. It seems to me that, I don't know, you've got everything is already in place. Logistically, you change nothing by leaving one or two machines in place and saying, okay, we're just going to make 300 and we'll just round it up for fun. 375 copies of selected movies, not even every single one, just kind of the big budget ones. And then just keep sending them to the drive-ins.
Yeah.
I don't know. It seems to me like it doesn't cost them anything. They still get the extra revenue. Fine, charge them, you know, like with the fuel surcharges now. When fuel shot up back in 2005 and all of a sudden people started seeing 30-cent fuel surcharges and stuff because to help cover the cost of fuel. Okay, well, charge them an extra $100 a flick. That's got to be cheaper than $70,000 a screen.
Right, yeah, no, that's true.
And then you keep your distribution in place, they keep the businesses open, people get to go to drive-ins.
Right.
I gotta say, I think people just aren't trying very hard on this one. I don't want them to close either. Our kids like to go. We take them in the spring and in the fall is when we take them to the movies. There's got to be an easier way.
Yeah, and again, these are the movie studios and the distributors who don't care about things like drive-ins. It's all about, hell, if it was up to them, they just want people to drive out to the movie theater and just pay, you know, $50 a family to go see Despicable Me at 6 o'clock at night. And
well,
pay the 3D.
Be fair, they also allow for home viewing now. It's only like $50,000 for the machine and then $500 a movie or something like that. They let you do that now.
Yeah, well. That's all I got.
Okay, well then we'll jump in with this fun stuff right here. Okay, got some Dumb and Dumber news here for you. According to FlickCited.com, courtesy of Josh Hill from there, Dumb and Dumber 2, Jeff Daniels says shooting will begin in September. That's right. Quote, I believe it's happening when I'm actually there staring at Jim Carrey. End quote. Fun stuff. That's really it. I mean, the point here is he wants to believe it. He thinks everything's in place. And quote, it looks like we're starting in September. End quote. As we have covered over this numerous times, it's had financing. It's lost financing. It's got its financing again. They got Jim Carrey. They don't have Jim Carrey. They got Jeff Daniels and Jim Carrey. And then one of them drops out. And then they don't know. Well, we're all... Everybody's there now. Looks like they're going to start in September. But just in case you are excited about this news, though, there's still something else that could probably spoil the whole thing if they're not careful. According to Yahoo Movies from The Wrap, courtesy of Brent Lang, Dumb and Dumber sequel producers sue over rights. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. The producers of the Dumb and Dumber sequel are suing to keep the producers of the original 1994 comedy out of the picture altogether, despite that those producers say they were, quote, intimately involved, end quote, in the making of the film. Essentially, it looks like Red Granite Productions, they're the ones who teamed up with New Line Pictures to get this thing rolling. The original producers went through New Line so many years ago, and they're saying that Red Granite's cutting them out and not letting them have any of the sequel money that they're entitled to. Red Granite says, we don't have anything signed with you people, we don't owe you anything, and we're already going through New Line, so F off. Red Granite is also kind of apparently known for this. There's been pointings at a lawsuit that the company settled back in October with producer Alexandra Milson after she alleged that the company improperly cut her out of the Martin Scorsese film The Wolf of Wall Street. I don't know. I just hope that something stupid like this does not end up costing the film, because I would really like to see this movie. I've been wanting this movie to happen for a long time, and I think it could be good. I even now, even with all the hype and all the years that have gone by, I really think that this could be a good movie.
Yeah, yeah. And it'll be a good kind of, I guess, reboot of Jim Carrey's career. Could be, at least. He definitely needs it.
Yeah, who would have ever thought the day would come when Jeff Daniels was in the better acting position than Jim Carrey? Certainly not them when the first movie was getting made, that's for sure. Next up, from Deadline Hollywood, deadline.com, we got the big caption, told ya, Sam Mendes to direct Bond 24. Deadline reported in May that Sony Pictures and MGM were in talks for Skyfall helmer Sam Mendes to return behind the camera for the next installment of the James Bond franchise. The studios, along with producers Michael G. Wilson and Barbara Broccoli, today confirmed Mendes will direct, with Daniel Craig reprising his role as Bond for the fourth time. There was a lot of speculation about Mendes returning, because in March he said he had made the, quote, very difficult decision, end quote, not to return, citing theater and TV commitments. Well, isn't that just going to be great? We're talking about a movie that made $1.1 billion worldwide. It was the biggest 007 film of all time, 8th highest grossing film of all time.
And the best 007 film in a while, I think.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Although, as much as people, again, I still stand by Quantum of Solace. I think it's a great movie. It's not as good as Skyfall, but I still think that it's also a great movie. It goes on to say, though, that John Logan is writing the next as-yet-untitled movie, which will bow in the UK on October 23rd, 2015, and then in the US on November 6th, 2015. All right, and in the I'm really, really sorry I took that role news, from SamuelWard.com, Johnny Depp plans to spend millions to return Wounded Knee to Native Americans. Turns out that the Daily Mail interviewed Johnny Depp, and buried at the bottom of the article was the revelation that Depp plans to spend millions of his own money to return the land Wounded Knee in South Dakota to Native Americans. It seems that the site, which of course was the scene of the 1890 massacre, is up for sale for $3.9 million. Local Native Americans say they cannot afford to buy it. Depp is outraged and wants to help. Quote, "It's very sacred ground, and many atrocities were committed against the Sioux there. And in the 1970s, there was a standoff between the feds and the people who should own that land. This historical land is so important to the Sioux culture, and all I want to do is buy it and give it back. Why doesn't the government do that?" End quote. What do you think, Tim? Altruism or...
I think it's known that whenever they were doing the Lone Ranger, he became very close to the Comanche tribe, because in order to film on their land, they had to get permission from the Comanches, and I think they also acted on as filming liaisons or something on that matter. Definitely not a producer. You'll never see a Native American as a producer, which I think is interesting. I think at least a couple of them should have been, especially on the Lone Ranger. Unless, of course, that they probably didn't want to associate themselves with the movie, but... you know, that's another thing. I honestly think Johnny Depp was doing it out of the kindness of his little Depperanian heart, and just doing it to help out people that he grew close to or became close with. But then at the same time, it also helps out with a little, kind of sweeping the Lone Ranger under the rug a little bit, or an attempts to. I guess it could work either way. But I'm hoping that he's more of a kind person in doing it, you know, out of kindness and out of being helpful than anything else.
Out of true altruism.
Yeah.
Indeed. Indeed. All right. Well, last two pieces of news for me revolve around being gay.
Not necessarily
what you think of it.
Whoa, hang on.
Or...
you?
Hmm?
You?
Yes. Yes, as a matter of fact, yes. No, these two pieces are not whether or not what you think about being gay or anything like that, but apparently being gay is of a great deal of importance to these last two pieces that I have. First up from MSN Now, Andrew Garfield has thought, and I'm sorry, it's gay, and I guess this is just because I'm a pervert. I love the title of this article. Andrew Garfield has thought... long and hard about making Spider-Man gay. I don't know what possessed somebody to make that the title of their article, but all right. Spider-Man star Andrew Garfield has a controversial suggestion about how to update the classic character. Make Spidey gay! The actor told a truly new definition to my Spidey senses are tingling. The actor told Entertainment Weekly he's had lengthy, quote, philosophical, end quote, discussions with film producers about switching the gender of Peter Parker's girlfriend, Mary Jane, a.k.a. MJ, played by Garfield's real-life girlfriend, Emma Stone. Quote, "What if MJ is a dude?" end quote, Garfield mused. Quote, "Why can't we discover that Peter is exploring his sexuality? It's hardly even groundbreaking," end quote. Garfield even knows who he wants to play his on-screen boyfriend. He wants the Wire star Michael B. Jordan. Quote, "He is so charismatic and talented," end quote. What do you think there, Tim? Should Spidey be gay?
Well, I will go along with what Mark Webb said when this was mentioned to him by Entertainment Weekly. And he said that, are you kidding? And that's kind of how why? It's kind of a slap in the face to the gay community if you're doing it just to do it. You know, just because, I think it'll be fun. And I just kind of have this little man crush on this guy, on this other actor. So I think it would just be fun. You don't do anything that is culturally significant just so that it's fun. Not just to... just to prove a point or anything, you know, you do it if it's culturally significant to the story and to the culture itself. That is why we have other movies that can be done too, not with superheroes. This is a superhero movie. It'll take everything away from what Spider-Man and the storyline of Spider-Man, and it would make another depth to the character that is not really needed for the superhero.
I agree, and I think that... especially in today's day and age, I am sure that there is someone out there who has already cleverly and genuinely written a gay superhero.
There's a Spider-Man.
Form or fashion. I'm sure they're already out there. I mean, for crying out loud, did anybody else see Chasing Amy? I don't know.
But like a year or two ago, somebody wrote, it was like an alternate universe, and there was a, it was like a Hispanic Spider-Man. It was a minority as Spider-Man, and he was also gay. So that's already a comic book, but that's from a different, you know, that's a different reality. That's a different version of the Spider-Man comic.
It seems to me that maybe his, I want to say his heart's in the right place, but he's just going about it all the wrong way. This is definitely not the right vehicle to even attempt to do something like that with, and maybe he was just doing it just to get people talking. I don't know. I definitely am not a fan of this idea at all. That's just me.
Yeah. Andrew Garfield says this quote, "I was kind of joking, but kind of not joking about MJ," end quote.
So could you say he was semi-joking?
I guess. I think he was just shooting off his web at it.
First we had long and hard, now we've got semi, right? No. I'm terrible, I know, it's okay. Oh. No worries. All right, so last but not least, from the Los Angeles Times website, latimes.com, The Hero Complex, Pop Culture Unmasked, we have Ender's Game to Deflate Boycott, Lionsgate Shuns Orson Scott Card. All right, here, I'm just going to read this one time. Here we go. In its statement released Friday, Lionsgate said, and I quote, "As proud longtime supporters of the LGBT community, champions of films ranging from Gods and Monsters to The Perks of Being a Wallflower, and a company that is proud to have recognized same-sex unions and domestic partnerships within its employee benefits policies for many years, we obviously do not agree with the personal views of Orson Scott Card and those of the National Organization for Marriage," end quote. They shouldn't have to be doing this. I feel like people are mad at Orson Scott Card, and they don't want anybody to, they don't want him to make money off of this product and off of his movies because of his views on gay marriage. And he's got extremely controversial views. It's not even so much, I'm just not pro-gay marriage. I mean, he's hard, very, very hard on homosexuality and gay marriage as a whole. And I can understand that. But this kind of, for me, this really goes back to the whole thing when we talked about a long time ago. Do you remember when we were picking on Morgan Freeman for trying to bring his politics into everything?
Oh, yeah.
I think it's kind of this. This is why you are hired. You are here for a job. I bought your book to entertain me. I go and see your movie because I'm paying you ungodly amounts of money to please me. Dance for me, little monkey on the stage. I don't care what your personal views are on anything. Just because you're a good writer does not automatically make you an authority on anything. I don't care if it's how to do a magic trick or gay marriage or what you think of Trayvon Martin or what you think of the president, what you think of politics, or whether or not you think that blue is a good color. None of these things matter. You are a good author, you are a good singer, you are a good dancer, you are a good actor. And that's fine. If we go and try and boycott people just because they have opinions about something, or as much as people hate using their celebrity to further controversial causes, it's just as bad as, I don't know, not going to Kroger because you know that that cashier is, I don't know, has some political opinion that you don't agree with. Well, why the hell you gotta mess with their job? If you don't like it, don't like it. And if you don't want to go see a movie or buy a book because that's your opinion and you don't think that they should use their station to promote things, well, that's fine. But there's nothing stopping you from doing the same thing in whatever field you're good at. And that's kind of, I just think it's going a little too far here, that you've got an entire movie studio scrambling to please watch this movie. The movie doesn't have anything to do with what Orson Scott Card thinks on any of these issues anyway. I don't know, I think that they're a little too worried about imagined reprisals that shouldn't be there in the first place. What do you think, Tim?
Believe it or not, I do think that the studio, it's in good sense for them to do damage control. Because a lot of these groups and organizations that would take an offense to the author saying, you know, the things that he has been saying, will look on the film in positive light because of what the studio is coming out and saying. And unfortunately, it's like kind of what the NAACP does. Nobody wants to see an NAACP on their ass or anything, so you kind of, you know, try to distance yourself away from what they're harping on, And then you can, you know, end up becoming in better light with them, and they won't actually go out and attack you. So I also think it's what the group of people. I mean, you look at what the movies, the targeting audience is, that with movies, especially action movies, anybody will go see an action movie or a sci-fi movie, or actually a popcorn movie, a summer blockbuster popcorn movie or whatever. That's, you know, the gay community, the straight community, blacks, whites, Asians, midgets, incredibly tall people, who, you know, anybody, pygmies, for God's sakes, yeah, it doesn't matter. It's just trying to distance themselves away from a problem, from the problem. Because once the word gets out there that, you know, if like their name is being associated with the person saying the bad things, and nobody wants to give money to that person, to that company. So at least if a group or somebody is online bashing the author, they might actually include a blurb saying, well, luckily the movie studio is actually disassociating itself away from what is being said. So there's kind of, I think there's a little more positiveness to what the studio is trying to do.
Well, okay then. I just think it's sad. They shouldn't
have. Oh, yeah, they shouldn't have to. I mean, I definitely agree.
I think it's ridiculous, yeah. And they shouldn't have to do this. I guess that's what I'm... That's my overarching thing.
Yeah.
Oh, well, they did it. I hope it works out for them. The end of the article, written here by John Horn, he says... he goes on to say this is the last paragraph of the article, and I think this is kind of telling, but I want to hear your opinion on this, too. It says, in an earlier statement to Entertainment Weekly, Card said, quote, now it will be interesting to see whether the victorious proponents of gay marriage will show tolerance toward those who disagreed with them when the issue was still in dispute. Ender's Game is set more than a century in the future and has nothing to do with political issues that did not exist when the book was written in 1984, end quote. Do you think even at this point, even Card kind of covered his ass a little bit? Or attempted to, in terms of the movie?
Too late, probably.
Too late. Okay, fair enough. I guess then, we are ready to move on to the next set, right?
Yes, sir.
All right, here we go. It's Three Square. Yes, Three Squared, where this week's Three Squared was most memorable performances by a musical artist in a movie. And when I say memorable, when we said memorable, that doesn't mean it has to be good, just something that really stuck out in your mind. For me, shall I go first on this one, sir?
Sure, go for it.
Oh, all right. So for me, what actually got me thinking about this was I was driving around about a week ago, and I started thinking about the end of the movie Free Jack, which is this just terrible movie about a race car driver who is trying to escape from this weird millionaire guy who's trying to get immortality. The millionaire dude's played by Anthony Hopkins. It's kind of crazy. But Mick Jagger's in this movie. And at the end of the movie, spoiler alert, this movie came out in 1992. You're probably not going to see it even now, so I'm not worried about spoiling the end of it. The way that Anthony Hopkins has found to get immortality is basically transfer your consciousness into somebody else, and he's doing it in this young Emilio Estevez. And so the transfer occurs, and of course it is a true transfer, so that means Emilio Estevez ends up in Anthony Hopkins' body, his consciousness ends up there, and so whatever. So then we get to the end of the movie, and after all the desperate attempts to escape and all this kind of whatever, blah, blah, you know, the transfer thing goes down, they're not sure if it worked out, and then Mick Jagger, who is kind of like Anthony Hopkins' right-hand man, he looks at Emilio Estevez and he says, all right, well, give me your personal access code. And by personal, he meant Anthony Hopkins. So Emilio Estevez immediately starts he belts out a number, like 8. And then Mick Jagger's like stops because he's about to shoot him because they think that they failed. He's like, well, go on. And he's like, 5, 3, 2, 9, 8, 4, 4, 2, 3. And so he screams out this number. And then Anthony Hopkins is like, no. And so Mick Jagger shoots Anthony Hopkins and everything, right? Am I doing a great job of explaining this movie? Isn't this a wonderful movie? I know you're happy. I know you're like, wow, I gotta see this movie now. No, you're
not. I wish there was like animation going along with this, because it's pretty entertaining.
Maybe somebody will get this and throw it up on YouTube. It'll be great. I don't know. And so then, you know, now everybody thinks that Emilio Estevez is the guy, and he's really Anthony Hopkins now. So he takes his girl, the chick. I'm pretty sure it was Rene Russo. Yes, it's Rene Russo. I don't know how much time has supposedly passed, but he basically says, "Oh, that's okay. I'll drive today, Jeeves," or whoever the fuck the limo driver guy was or whatever. And that's when Mick Jagger stops him and he says, "Ha! I knew you weren't him." And then Estevez is like, "What?" He's like, "Anthony Hopkins," because I can't remember the guy's name. "Anthony Hopkins never drove." And I'm like, "Okay, so that's the thing?" And I'm like, "Well, why did you let me go on if you knew the number was wrong?" He's like, "Oh, I hated him anyway, blah, blah, blah." And so then they get into the car and they drive away. And I'm like, okay, so this just made me, I just remember, and Mick Jagger is a terrible, terrible actor. Say what you want about the influence he's had on rock and roll, whether or not you agree with it, what the Rolling Stones have done for geriatric rock and roll performances as well. He cannot act. And it literally so emblazoned into my mind, this terrible performance in this terrible movie, that I was thinking about it in the car, and I was like, man, I wonder what other people have had performances, either good or bad, that have just completely emblazoned themselves into your mind, and that is how I came up with this 3 squared for this week. And I've already given you the first one, so I'm just going to go ahead and move to the next one. Second one is Cannonball Run, okay? Cannonball Run 2. Now, this is the sequel to the 1982 Cannonball Run, which was actually moderately well received by critics, but it made a lot of money. And it was the idea of the original Cannonball Run race, and they go where you basically start in LA and race to New York or the other way around or something like that. And it's basically no holds barred, no rules, just get to the other side as fast as humanly possible. The winner gets, I don't know, a buttload of money or something like that. Well, they go and they finish the race. This is something that people have actually tried to do, even as recently as I want to say is about a year and a half ago, but it's just so difficult now because of radar and police detection and helicopters and radio and all that kind of stuff that it makes it virtually impossible to do anymore. But they thought they had such a good time with the first Cannonball Run that they decided to make a Cannonball Run 2. And this one was just terrible. It's nowhere near as good as the first one. It's just, they tried to take the gags and run them, and what worked in the first movie was just recycled and old by the second movie. The jokes are even worse. They did try to get a lot of the stars back, but they didn't get anywhere near the amount of stars from the first one to come back for the second one, so they got a lot of, at the time, B-level kids, people who were just starting out in the American cinema screen, so people like Tony Danza, Mary Lou Henner. But they also were able to bring back people like Burt Reynolds, Dom DeLuise. They did get Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr. What's interesting about this is the end of the movie culminates when they go and they have to meet the head of this mafia type of people. And they're like, oh, everybody's all scared to have to meet him and then they go into the office and the chair is sitting there, and of course they got the chairs facing the window. It's not like, and then it spin around and there it is, Frank Sinatra. And he was definitely, he had aged, but it was just his cameo in the movie really made this memorable for me. It was a small thing. He did a great job, but not only was this the final film appearance for both Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra, this was the final time that the original Rat Pack was ever together on screen. And just that little dynamic, you can't hide it. Even in a cameo, even in the 45 seconds that Frank Sinatra's on the screen, is something that you cannot deny that much star power and that much camaraderie and years of friendship. It's just all there. You can see it and you can see how it worked out, and it was just fantastic. And that 45 seconds does not make this movie worth watching, but that 45 seconds is worth watching. And that's why that made my list here.
So YouTube it.
Exactly. Yes. Just YouTube. Frank Sinatra, Cannonball Run 2. Last but not least, this one was actually good. I was legitimately surprised by this movie. My mom rented this from Blockbuster, and because you know it is kind of, I don't want to say it's necessarily a chick flick, but it is kind of a gushy drama. It does lean towards the chick flick side of it, but I think that there's still enough redeeming qualities that you can just say it's a drama. This movie is Mermaids. It's the 1990 comedy drama film that was directed by Richard Benjamin and actually stars Cher, Bob Hoskins, Winona Ryder, and Christina Ricci in her first film role. And this basically covers the story. It's the story of a mom and her two daughters, single mom, two daughters, who kind of go to a, I want to say it's like a little New England town, somewhere in Massachusetts, something like that, Maine, what have you. They basically just kind of run from their problems, but they do love each other as a family and try to work things out. And you've got the issues of the mom that are trying to work themselves out, along with the coming of age story of Winona Ryder. And one of the few times that a kid has been truly useful as a plot device and did a good job from Christina Ricci's character in this movie. This is just really, for me, it's a really good movie. I was surprised. Who knew Cher could act? I mean, I knew she had the variety show back in the 70s. She had never really done movies that I was aware of up until this point. And she, of course, started off for Sonny and Cher back in the 70s. When I saw this, I was like, man, she looks good. And then I was like, wow, she can act. And then it was like, holy crap, the movie's good. And that was also when I figured out, wait a minute, Bob Hoskins has an English accent? What? So, yeah, there was all that as well. Lots of discovery, good movie, and that is my final choice. So, first up, worst choice or worst impression, but still burned in my mind, Mick Jagger from 1992's Free Jack. Second one is the final on-screen performance of Frank Sinatra in 1984's Cannonball Run 2, and last but not least, 1990's Mermaids starring Cher.
All right, cool. Not bad, not bad. My three are from three, I think, are really good movies, three movies that I've enjoyed. They're actually from three different decades. Actually, I'll start with the newest. Why not? It's only from 1992, over 21 years ago, and it is Alice Cooper in the film Wayne's World, directed by Penelope Spheres, I believe. Don't quote me on that. I am just going to go off the knowledge that I have in my brain computer up here and just say Penelope Spheres. So Alice Cooper in Wayne's World. It's a very short scene, but his line, when he gives a short and sweet oral history of Milwaukee, it is just brilliant.
So, do you come to Milwaukee often?
Well, I'm a regular visitor here, but Milwaukee has certainly had its share of visitors. The French missionaries and explorers were coming here as early as the late 1600s to trade with the Native Americans.
In fact, isn't Milwaukee an Indian name?
Yes, Pete, it is. Actually, it's pronounced Milwaukee, which is Algonquin for the good land.
I was not aware of that.
I think one of the most interesting aspects of Milwaukee is the fact that it's the only major American city to have ever elected three socialist mayors.
Does this guy know how to party or what? Huh? Huh?
Wasn't that hysterical? Alice Cooper. Who would have known? Great comedic timing. It just works perfectly with the campiness of the movie. And as well as, the character is also great because he prompts the famous We're Not Worthy from both Garth and Wayne Campbell. Now, my second flick is from 1983, and it is David Bowie in the film Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. Now, this is a very interesting movie that I actually saw for the first time a couple years ago. You'll find it on Criterion Blu-ray and DVD, which is an excellent copy with excellent bonus features and a documentary of the making of the movie. And the film is about the relationships among four men that are in a Japanese prisoner of war camp. Two of them are captured British soldiers, and the other two are part of the Japanese military. And David Bowie gives a wonderful performance. He's one of the two leads. He plays Major Jack Strafer Colliers. And then there's Tom Conti, who plays the Colonel John Lawrence, which the title is kind of about, Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. Now, there is a particular scene in the movie that is, I guess, probably the most famous scene from the entire movie pertaining to David Bowie. And it is the infamous kiss that David Bowie gives to Captain Yonoi, which is played by Ryuichi Sakamoto. And it is the make love, not war kiss. It's like a statement, which is coming off as to the horrors of the captain who receives the kiss, because you have David Bowie walking up to you with that very odd David Bowie face with the two different eye colors and that chiseled cheeks and his blonde, boyish, raggedy hair, wearing the uniform, just kind of like walking and towards you and then looking at you, taking these short little strides, and you know if he's going to like shank you or make out with you. And it actually turns out he actually makes out with the guy. Not quite make out. Gives him awkward kisses on the cheeks. Aren't really on the cheeks. They're mainly kind of on the side lips. And it prompts a very odd reaction from the Captain Yonoi as he kind of just faints out of bewilderment from, you know, what just happened. And then the other Japanese men just go on to tackle David Bowie to the ground. And that's pretty much what leads to the dramatic ending of the movie. I don't want to spoil it for you. It's a great film. Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, with David Bowie. Lastly, my final 3 squared of my most memorable part in a film made by a musician is from 1979, and that part is played by Sting in the motion picture Quadrophenia. Yes, the rock opera by the band The Who, created after the success of Tommy. And Sting plays a cool mod icon opposite Phil Daniels, who's the rebellious teenager in the film's posters and whatnot. Very iconic character. He's the mod guy. Sting's the rebellious one. He's the cool cat that always gets the chicks that the dorky guys strive to be. He helps out the dorky guys. He's not a complete asshole. He rides the motorcycles. He is the mod guy. And what I liked about his character in the movie, and the movie in general, really, is that it plays the characters of how the 1960s should have been, or how it actually was, and how movies should portray the 1960s in London at that time. But I mean, this is before the hippies. This is the big mod craze. This is a change of music. This is the revolutionizing of rock and roll, of music itself. You have the parents that are trying to control these kids that, you know, they're just going out of control. They want to party. They want to have sex with whoever. They want to do this. They want to do that. They want to be rebellious. And Sting's character is the mascot of this generation. And though he's not in the movie a whole lot, he is used wonderfully in the movie, though with not many lines. He just kind of, his presence just really steals the show. So again, my 3 movies are 1992's Wayne's World with Alice Cooper, 1983's Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, David Bowie, and then finally Quadrophenia, 1979, Sting.
Delightful, sir, delightful. And for next week's 3 Squared, we are going to be doing our favorite movies with a color in the title. For instance, just, you know, think like red, maybe Black Swan. You know, think of movies with colors in the title. So that's what we're going to be doing for next week. And now it brings us to the movies. Yes, the movies. All right, our movies for this week are Pacific Rim, The Expendables 2, and London Boulevard. Tim, what would you like to start with, sir?
Let's go with London Boulevard. That might be the easiest one to discuss. So why not?
London Boulevard. All right, we're going to start with, then, definitely good idea. Let's go ahead and start with this movie. And we're going to go ahead and do something new and exciting here. We're going to give you the little synopsis this way. A man newly released from prison falls in love with a reclusive young movie star and finds himself in a duel with a vicious gangster. And for a little bit of further fun and excitement, we'll just do some trailer action for you.
Inside, Billy. Ever. For no one.
Then don't get caught.
I might have a job for you. Are you handy?
What with hammers and such?
We've seen her in films.
They're outside my house all the time.
The paparazzi.
Sometimes they come over the walls. Could you get someone off the property if you needed to? Could you help look after me?
Yes.
It's me.
birthday, remember?
How'd you get this number?
You really think I'm gonna let you all free around this planet? He said you owe him.
I don't know him anything.
You're a gangster. You're part of my firm.
There are other things I can do, and maybe I want to do them.
If I fell in love with you, what would you do about it?
Everything.
You're an accessory now. It's a bit like being married, you know, it's for life.
Does he know about my sister?
Everybody knows about your sister.
Listen, there are some people after me, and they might try and hurt you.
You're gone, Matt! That will kill everybody. Everyone who belongs to you.
I want you out of the country until I settle something.
Will you come with me?
Yeah, I will. Something I have to do first. I was meant to, and you know what they said.
But some of it was true. You best get out of London.
Don't worry about it. And after all this, won't you give me a
smile? You and me could be great. People will remember us.
You don't want me to be a gangster. Nobody wants me to be a gangster, because I could not stop if I started. You'll be the first to die.
Now that you've heard the trailer and you know what the synopsis is, I gotta say, this movie didn't really do it for me. There was just, it was too weird for me. I got it, I understood it. I didn't even mind the ending so much. I thought it was a stupid ending, but it didn't really bother me. I don't know. Were they trying to do like a... Were they just trying to have fun and come up with a modern-day Hamlet or something?
Well, it's based off
a book. Something, or?
So, you know, I guess there was only so much that William Monahan could really have done with the script, given the source material. Unless he actually went through and jazzed it up a bit, I don't know for sure. But the movie is definitely definitely weird. However, to me, I would have given this movie, you know, going out of the 5-star bracket, 2.5 to, probably 3 stars. But because of the last 20 minutes of the movie, which I thought was edited wonderfully, and with the use of music, which there's a ton of music. They rely on music way too much in this movie, but it actually works for the last 20 minutes. And to me, it flowed at a wonderful pace. It went smoothly. It was funny. It ended the movie, I guess, how they should have ended it, given what they gave us to work off of, if that makes any sense whatsoever. So, because of that, I gave the movie 3.5 to 4 stars out of 5.
I don't like the way that it plays out. I think this is one of those movies, it's not even trying to take itself too seriously. This is one of those movies where they're trying to be too smart. And I think they're trying to be existential. And yes, while the soundtrack is good, I must agree, the soundtrack is good in this movie, I have to also agree that they were trying way too hard to make the music mean something. And you are then left with a whole bunch of disjointed characters and people doing things without any real reason for doing them. The only two people in the movie that you have any real understanding of why they behave the way that they behave and why they play out the way that they do are Colin Farrell's character and the boss guy, Rob. Yeah, Rob Grant. He's played by Ray Winstone.
I mean, those are the only ones that you fully understand, because Keira Knightley's character, there's something off about her that you're really not sure about ever. And then there's the, I don't know if he was like the caretaker, the really goofy British guy.
Right. Oh, David Thewlis?
Yeah, like you really don't know too much about him.
Rather?
Yeah.
And that's the whole thing. And so that's why for me, the ending is, I understand what you mean by it kind of ends the only way that it can. And that's why I say I think the ending is stupid, but it didn't bother me per se. Like I wasn't like, okay, oh my God, I can't believe it, whatever. But things like why he agrees to help at the end. And then specifically during the end credits, I'm not going to say anything other than his actions during the end credits for me are kind of like, I don't get it. And for me, it went from 3 stars. Like the whole movie would have been 3 stars, but where you are finding the pace to be quickened and the play out to be lively and something that redeems the movie, I find that's what kind of killed the movie for me. And so I went from 3 stars to about 2.5 based on that last 20 minutes of the movie. This is just kind of a weird movie, man.
Yeah, you really have to pay attention because a lot of the stuff, unlike a lot of movies, especially American movies, where character progression is seen through from the is seen by the audience via dialogue and what's really given to you at face value. And this movie, which at times is really difficult to understand what the hell these people are saying because they're not speaking proper British. They are speaking slang. And it is
well, not
very
only are
difficult.
They speaking slang, but for the first 15 minutes of the movie, everybody fucking mumbles. Everybody fucking mumbles. And it's like, what the fuck did he just say?
Right, so yeah, so you just have to rely on like what people are doing, their actions, how they react with one another, and to whereas you weren't familiar with or you didn't understand why that one character does what he does at the end of the movie. See, I through the movie can see his character progression and why he turned out to being a an inner badass, I guess. Because I guess to me, I just noticed that there was something he wanted to be. There was just something inside of him to where he wanted to be more, more of somebody. That he had this job where he was the caretaker or whatever job he had for this actress. He just sat around, smoked pot all day, was an actor, did this.
Well,
did
no,
that.
He.
And
it was because he wanted to be an actor. He truly wanted the role of a lifetime to redeem him for all of his previous. Just sitting around doing nothing since he spiked a drink those years previously.
Right.
And so I get that aspect of his character. I understand his motivation as, I must have this one last role. I still don't get why he just says yes, because there are so many different ways to do that without having to do all the crap that he did. It just, for me, it didn't work. I mean, it's so, it doesn't ruin the movie per se. It didn't work. Clearly it worked for you, and that's why you're giving it a bonus star and I'm taking away half a star at the end.
Yeah, and this is one of those weird movies to where I can't really argue my position because I can totally see where you're coming from, and I just think that I just don't know. I mean, it's just weird. It's just one of those movies where it's like it's nothing special, but it's I don't know. I don't know. I'm just gonna shut up and not say anything.
I think we can both agree that while we found different things to like and dislike about the movie, that it is safe to say that we both agree that this is a weird movie.
Agreed.
Okay. So check it out. Just know that you've been warned. The movie's weird, so if you want to check it out, do so at your own risk. Go ahead and do Expendables 2, which for me was probably the most delightful sequel I have seen in many years. I want to point out that it is not a good sequel. I would like to further point out that while they improved on the Expendables in every conceivable way, this movie is still somehow worse than the Expendables. And yet, I loved every digitally blood-soaked, totally 90s catchphrase-filled, action movie cliched moment of this movie.
And there's a lot. There is a lot of them. Especially with each action star referencing each other's movies, which...
Yes.
Which I see, that got a little too much for me. Especially at the airport scene there at the end where...
Oh, by the end of it, yeah.
Yeah, it's like...
You've been back long enough. That's my turn.
Yeah, it's just... Yeah. Okay, so...
Oh, yippee-ki-yay.
Yeah, exactly. Or oh, who are you, Rambo? Stuff like that.
Yeah.
Well,
who's going to show up next, Rambo? Yeah, I gotta say, this one was truly every fanboy's... Every action flick fanboy's fantasy come true. You've got the whole crew returns, plus they bring... Thor's little brother in, so that you got him as well. Liam Hemsworth comes in, and well, basically, here, you just listen to it. This is a very self-explanatory plot. It's basically simple mission that goes awry and a little bit of vengeance thrown in, and believe it or not, Jean-Claude Van Damme is the bad guy.
A decent bad guy, actually.
Yeah, take a listen to the trailer and then we can go from there.
What do you want from the church?
I knew the day would come when you were going to pay me back. You can't let the contents of that safe fall into the wrong hands.
track them, find them, kill them.
You're gonna need more men if you expect to get out of here alive.
You're terminated.
In your dreams.
Here we go!
You're not doing what I think you're doing.
Yeah, I am.
The Expendables 2.
You're gonna need a new plane.
In theaters August 17th.
Alright, so now that you've got the idea of what The Expendables 2 is about, we already knew I was going to like it.
Obviously. I did. See, I also went back and I listened to our review of the first Expendables movie, and you were upset, my friend. Especially coming off of both reviewing Hobo with a Shotgun and this being the next one. You were... Oof. You had your underwear in a wad, my friend.
Dude,
I almost made you cry.
I don't know if it was that bad.
It was pretty bad. You words couldn't form in your mouth. You were pretty livid. And
it's
I hope
because you were
again.
Supposed to like the first one. You know, I still contend this was an age thing. I'm not gonna lie.
Well, I just honestly think that you and I both look at certain movies drastically different, as in what you expect. You know, not saying that one's right or not right. It's just, you know, what one expects. And it could very well be an age thing. However, I know people that are your age that don't like it for many of the same reasons. But I will say that with Expendables 2, it is definitely an improvement story-wise. It is fun. They get to do a lot more fun and exciting things, and especially with action adventure movies, which this one is definitely more so an action adventure than the first one, the plot keeps moving forward. They keep going to interesting places where the scenery is interesting, where the sets are interesting, even though there's really no reason for them to be at these particular places at any given time. They go there regardless, and by God, does it look good. So the scenic design and the set design and all those people did a very good job. However, I gotta say that whenever a big stunt is performed, it takes about, five, six shots to show that stunt. And holy shit, that annoys the balls. Well, not necessarily the balls. That annoys the shit out of me. I don't want to say annoys the balls out of me because that would be a little weird. It annoys the shit out of me, because you have an explosion, and you can compare some of this stuff you look at James Bond movies. The James Bond movies of the 60s, the 70s, 80s, even the 90s James Bond movies, when they would have these big, grandiose action sequences. Well, they're spending all that money, so they want you to see it. That's the point of having them, is for you to see it. So with those movies, you have the big, or not necessarily the big wide-angle shot of it, but you have a shot of it to where you see it, and every so often you'll get a couple angles of it. You get, you know, various shots of the explosion or the stunt or whatever. However, in The Expendables, and they have some awesome stunts, they have some awesome explosions, they have some bitchin' car crashes. However, your perception of these stunts and car crashes and stuff is limited because of the shots. You see the explosion, and then just within like 3 seconds, there's already like five different shots of that one explosion. And holy crap, that just annoyed me to death. And it doesn't happen every single time in this movie, but it happens often to be noticed, I guess. The movie is very cliched. I knew this going in. That's why a lot of the cliches didn't bother me, especially with the whole situation of, well, you have to dislocate something before it explodes to retrieve this document. However, I have to warn you that the thing you have to dislocate, the password changes every 5 hours. You know, one of those scenarios. But in this movie, the password changes every 127 seconds. Now, how did they get this information? I have no idea. But they got it and they rolled with it. And it really didn't make any difference to the plot. And that's what kind of seemed like with a lot of these cliches and these moments in the movie to make certain scenes seem a lot more tense, I guess. Which they started saying stuff like that just really didn't mean anything. Because when they got to the thing to open up, to where they had to get the code right, Well, it really didn't matter that it changed every single 120 seconds because they basically got the code from the code thing, so it really didn't matter what was going on. What did matter was the two guys holding the door open before it crushed the woman trying to do the code. So what was initially the, I don't know, the obstacle wasn't the obstacle once they got there. So a lot of stuff like that kind of happened. There was a lot of unnecessary kills. Not necessarily that people died was unnecessary, but it was how they died. For example, when Steven Seagal was going to kill the guy that becomes the object of the vengeful mercenaries, the vengeful expendables to go off and capture Steven Seagal.
Who's Steven Seagal?
Oh, not Steven Seagal. See, I'm getting this movie mixed up with Machete. I meant, what's his name?
I don't know. You're just getting them mixed up with Sylvester Stallone, I guess?
No, the bad guy.
Oh, Jean-Claude
Van Damme. Yeah, Jean-Claude Van Damme. See, I was even about to say Lou Diamond Phillips for some reason. Totally way off.
Oh my god.
Yeah. Jean-Claude Van Damme is about to stab Liam Hemsworth, but instead of just, you know, stabbing him, he gives the knife to another guy to hold, and he does a roundhouse kick and kicks it into him. And granted, it looks really cool, but it was unnecessary. Again, this is one of those things that didn't bother me too much, but as the movie went along, I just noticed a lot of stuff like that. A lot of old-fashioned oldies music, and a lot of blues music in this movie, I guess to establish that these are older guys who are simple in their musical tastes, but this music just pops up everywhere. And I think this is more of a director's fault, because maybe the director just thought people can relate to older fans of these actors can relate to the guys more because of this older music, because they're in a Russian town that was used, that's actually a replica of New York or some kind of U.S. city block, where the U.S. during the Cold War would practice maneuvers in case they ever invaded the United States. Well, the Expendables make camp in this pizzeria that was built, and there's a jukebox. Now, all the power is shut off. There is no electricity powering anything, but yet they got the jukebox running. And the jukebox is playing, just so happens to have all of their oldies classic hits that they all love, which I thought was kind of interesting. And also they had the music playing in the cave where they're, you know, they're in that cave closely in the movie where the whole compound kind of caves in and they're stuck all in there and suddenly music is playing in there. And I know it's not because the music is just playing throughout the movie, but they actually have the sound effects as if the music is playing within that room, which was interesting. And I can just go on and on with all these things, especially with Chuck Norris. Whenever you finally see Chuck Norris for the first second of the 5 minutes he's in the movie, they do the man with no name, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, as the camera pans up and you see it's Chuck Norris. Again, you know, that's another cliche among a whole lot of other cliches and random shit that goes on.
Yes, but if you're gonna bring up a Chuck Norris cliche, Tim, you have to bring up the "heard you got bit by a cobra." Yes, but after 7 long, painful days, the cobra finally died.
Right, exactly. Yeah, stuff like that. And, you know, kind of like what we were talking about before with everybody kind of quoting or bringing up each other's past movies. They were playing into their own, I guess, their own pop culture references and pop culture stereotypes, which is fine when it's done right, but with this action movie, to me at least, it kind of took away from the whole movie with as much as they're doing it, because you have Sylvester Stallone's character, who he's the one character that has any emotional tie-ins within the entire movie, pretty much. He has an emotional tie with all of his past shit that happened with him that was brought up in the first movie, and he also has the emotional tie-in he has with the relationship he had with Liam Hemsworth's character that dies at the beginning of the movie. You have to feel some sort of connection in some way with him, as you do with a lot of action movies where you actually have to care for the action hero. However, I couldn't, because you have all of this camp and ridiculousness going on, that there wasn't a balance between campiness, humor, action, and what little drama there was. It just kind of took away. And then plus you have all these action stars, and you rarely see them all actually perform their duty, like do what they have to do. Like Terry Crews, Dolph Lundgren. I forget the other. I think he's a wrestler. The other wrestler guy.
But there was no wrestler.
No wrestler in that one.
There's no wrestler in this at all. You've got, take your pick. You've got Coltrane, Sloan, Coltrane, Jason Statham, Coltrane, Jet Li,
Coltrane,
Dolph Lundgren,
Robbie Coltrane. That's who I'm talking about.
Randy Couture.
Oh, Randy Couture. Did I call him Coltrane?
Something like that. Yeah. He was a UFC fighter.
Oh, UFC fighter. Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah, like with him, I mean, once you have Bruce Willis, Stallone, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and when, you know, Chuck Norris is on screen, all you see is them do their things. You don't really see Couture, Terry Crews, even when you see Jet Li do the thing, but he exits the movie pretty far in advance. And even Jason Statham, you really don't see Jason Statham doing a whole lot during the movie. So it just seemed like every time a bigger name action star was on screen or was in a scene, they took precedent with the audience, you know, or they took precedent in the scene. So, you know, that just kind of got me thinking. So basically, to wrap this all up with a nice little bow on top on, you know, from my point of view, is that though this movie is better than the first one, that the story is more entertaining and their adventure is more, I guess, exciting, they're just trying too hard to top the last one, as well as each performance trying to top each other's performance, that it just kind of took me out of the movie more so than drew me in to the movie.
The rebuttal here is simple. Everything that he was talking about is true, is 100% spot on, and you're probably going to love it anyway. The critics did. The money spoke $300-something million later. And we're going to come back for round three next year, because Expendables 3 is scheduled for release in August of 2014.
Yes, we will be, and probably 4 and 5. And
we're going to do it again, man. Yeah. All right, so last but not least, we have Pacific Rim. I did not want to see this movie. I figured any movie where you have to have 17 different trailers just to explain what the fuck the movie was about has got to not be all that good. Even given the fact that it's Guillermo del Toro, don't get me wrong, I'm not hating on him. I like his stuff. But we're dealing with I like how it's like, oh, it's such an original movie. Go see this movie. You're not going to see. And yet, anyone who is even remotely familiar with the anime world, which granted over here is probably not that many people, percentage-wise or per capita-wise, anybody who is remotely familiar with anime is going to look at this and go, wow, this is pretty much just Neon Genesis Evangelion, where big, huge monster aliens come and invade the Earth and we build mech warriors to stop them. That's not to say that this is a bad movie, but it's not as original as people think that it is. But why don't y'all take a listen and then we can figure out what this is here is all about.
Took me a while to find you.
What do you want?
I need pilots and your fighting skills.
I'm guessing that wasn't your first choice.
I'm a big believer in second chances.
Prepare for neural handshakes.
Initiating neural handshake in 4.
Release for drop.
The drift. Two pilots melding memories with the body of a machine. The deeper the bond, the better you fight.
At the edge of our hope. At the end of our time. We have chosen not only to believe in ourselves, but in each other.
All right, Marco. I'm ready! This is for real! Now!
Damn! 2,500 tons of awesome.
The world is coming to an end. Today we face the monsters that are at our doors and bring the fight to them! You can finish this! Today we are canceling the apocalypse!
Now that we've got that under our belts, I will say that I was actually surprised. I didn't realize. It took me forever. It was bothering the piss out of me. Who is that dude? Who's the lead guy? I can't figure out. And I was like, oh my God. It's what's-his-face from Sons of Anarchy. Charles Hunnam? Or Charlie Hunnam?
Yeah. Yeah, it is, isn't it?
Yeah. He's... And then I thought that was kind of cool because Ron Perlman having his little role in this movie. And I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. Even though they don't share any screen time. Still thought that was kind of cool. I will say that this movie, while seemingly tremendously overacted, was still surprisingly good. I thought that the action sequences were definitely very well done. We're looking at you, Transformers. You could understand what was happening on the screen. You could make out everything that was going on. And they were definitely well thought out and well executed action scenes. The story was as good as it could be, I think, for what this movie was about. I kind of like the idea that this could be just a standalone movie that allows for other movies kind of this style, of a similar style. I saw a lot of Independence Day in this movie. I saw a lot of overacting in this movie. I like the multicultural cast, and I like the global aspect of the movie. It was really kind of cool. And the inclusion of other areas that the movie takes place in. But for me, at the end of the day, 3 stars. That's kind of where I land on this one.
Not bad.
It's, I liked it.
Yeah.
I will say, I texted Tim as soon as the movie was over, and I was like, this movie was not terrible. And that is pretty much all I have to say about it. Finish her up, Tim.
Finish her up. Well, I'm glad to hear that Matt and I both got our Pacific Rim jobs and enjoyed it.
How long you been holding on to that one?
2 minutes. Exactly 2 minutes.
Nice.
Yeah, I've been watching it here on the Skype countdown. I will say that if it wasn't for some of the supporting characters, especially Ron Perlman's character and Charlie Day's and Bern Gorman's character, they were the two zany, goofy doctors. They added so much to this movie that without them, the movie would have been a dull, acted movie with amazing battle scenes and special effects. But it was with their quirkiness that I was able to enjoy the movie and actually buy the story and buy what was going on and actually kind of believe what I was seeing on screen, even though it's ridiculous. But you know what? It was fun and entertaining. So this is definitely a summer blockbuster, popcorn-eating kind of movie. And this is by far one of the better movies I have seen all year. Definitely enjoyed it more so than Man of Steel. Probably Star Trek. Definitely liked it better than Star Trek. Pure enjoyment. You had the colors, which were great. Well thought out action scenes, like what Matt said. You have the build up, and this is exactly what I was looking forward to in this movie that I knew Guillermo del Toro would succeed in doing, and that is when all the perils of fighting and all of the characters striving for this one goal and objective and not quite reaching it, the movie has to build up, so whenever they do reach it, or when the giant robots deliver that final blow to one of the monsters in Tokyo, you know, you just want the entire audience to stand up and cheering, or let alone you want to stand up and cheer with inside of yourself. You want to feel your heart flutter a little bit, and this is exactly what this movie did for me. It didn't happen consistently throughout the movie, but there were at least 2 or 3 key moments where I was holding my breath, and then once a blow hit, and then a monster, you know, fell down, or especially when one of the robots was walking down Tokyo, and it just cuts to the robot, and you see them carrying a giant ship, and they just swing up the ship, and they turn around, they just haul off, and knock the living shit out of the monster. I mean, it was great. So the movie did succeed in that aspect. However, where the movie does falter is with the main actor. Now, this main actor, Charlie Hunnam, or Hunnam, he wasn't an action star. And that's kind of what I would think this guy was supposed to be. He was very soft-spoken, a super nice guy he came across being, but he wasn't like the goofy, funny, charismatic actor that should have played that character and therefore should have carried that story arc over beyond what Charlie Hunnam had done. So that is where I see the fault lies, in my point of view, is with the underacting by the main character, as well as some of the crazy, unbelievable story lines where they had to go in so much description and so much detail to point out and reference and to explain just to get the audience on board to believe what they were seeing on screen. So there was just no gestalt, which is absolutely needed in action heroes, is the gestalt. John McClane has gestalt in Die Hard. Action star. Funny man. Good-looking guy. Can deliver lines well. Can deliver humor well. It's the gestalt that every action hero needs. And this is definitely what the character of Riley Beckett is lacking.
All right. Well, awesome. Well, then, I guess so, you know, for me, 3 stars. For you?
4? 3.5 to 4.
Okay. Very cool. All right. Well, then I guess it's time to bring this wonderful episode to a close. Shall I do the spiel?
Spiel on.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, the music you've been listening to, as always, has been brought to you by our music partners, Cries of Solace. You can check them out at criesofsolace.com. You can go to reverbnation.com, myspace.com, or facebook.com/criesofsolace and check them out there as well. As far as we're concerned, well, we're still the SLS cast. You can go to slscast.com. Check out our website there. You can always send us email to theslscast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter @theslscast. You can go to Facebook and go search us there as well. And, of course, subscribe to us on iTunes. So, until next week, this is Matt saying that thanks to Jean-Claude Van Damme, I can say, when I was 24, I was full of life. I was that ham who wanted to be famous, a movie star, all that stuff. I think it's cool. But it was not what I was searching for, really. It was more a delusion.
And this is Tim saying... Cheers.
Have a great week, guys.
Thanks again for listening to the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim. Remember that you can find us at slscast.com, at the SLS Cast for Twitter, also on Facebook, and you can always subscribe on iTunes. Thanks again for listening.